From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 Chai FM.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the show on this Monday morning. That is the first official day of spring. I suppose yesterday was the first official day, but this is the first official weekday of spring. And isn't it fantastic looking outside? Nice and warm, but not too hot. And just really, really lovely all round, which is a beautiful way to start the show for today. And we have a big springing one for you because we're going to be bringing you a range of different stories, insights and information to help you make sense of your world, whether it's here locally in Johannesburg and South Africa or abroad in Israel and around the world. That is what we're here to do on your favorite Jewish current affairs and culture show on 101.9 Chai FM. So what are we talking about today? Well, we've got a whole range of topics. We're going to be talking about the settling of South African politics. The government of national unity is in, but is it done? That's the question. And what effect is it having on the rest of our political system? That is one of the things we're going to be talking about. We're also going to be talking about UCT, the University of Cape Town. Local Jewish professors are suing them, and we're going to find out why. We're going to be talking about the fact that it's Elul coming up, and that's on Tuesday, Wednesday, new month, and that means Rosh Hashanah, and we're going to be finding out about the Israeli technology that is making life a little bit sweeter for rural women in the Eastern Cape. And also, we will be looking at archaeology. You know, we like to do archaeology if there's interesting archaeology on this show. So, in the First Temple times, a seal has been found. Not a seal like rah, rah, seal, like a seal, which is something that was used for creating documents from the First Temple. So, we're going to be talking about this new archaeological seal that's been found. And we're also going to be doing one small moment of reflection about what has been happening with the hostages. So that is all to come on the show today. Do stay tuned because it is going to be super interesting because that is what we like to do here. And do stay tuned. So I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM. We'll chat to you in a bit.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. And on the New Blue Review, we're going to be talking about the GNU and where is the GNU going. The GNU being the Government of National Unity and what has been happening there. Now, let me just lay it out for you in a kind of a way, because we are very, very used to, in South Africa, coalition politics. You hear about it in the news, particularly in local council level. You'll hear from time to time, this person moved there and that person moved there and this created a change in the council. And people have almost started to switch off. But start to listen to what's happened in the last few weeks. Several municipalities down in the Western Cape, the FF Plus, right, the FF Plus, combined with the ANC to get rid of the DA mayor in not one but two different municipalities. The DA decided to work with the Good Party and the Socialist Workers' Party in another Western Cape province, get rid of the ANC. We've had a major defection from the EFF to the Nkontuwe Sizwe Party, and a number of smaller parties basically abandoning their current platforms to join the MK. So, for example, the SARA Party, the South African Rainbow Alliance, closed its shop and decided to join the MK. We've had a mayor of the city of Johannesburg from Al-Jamar being deposed and an ANC one being put in place with the help of Action SA. We've got a number of other issues going on that are not necessarily are more rhetorical, I would say, less than the actual movements. But you know, the head of the South African Communist Party went on a big podcast the other day and slammed the current government over creating the GNU in the first place, even though the South African Communist Party has five different ministers or four different ministers that are actually in the GNU. And so that's caused a spat between them. And then the real big one that nearly happened last week was that Action SA nearly turned over the city of Tshwane to the ANC for no reason, just sort of somasur because. And that is, and that was like a very close run thing. And in the end, they sort of withdrew they didn't withdraw, the ANC kind of withdrew their motion of no confidence. And bear in mind that Tshwane has been kind of the big leading light in terms of the coalitions in the last sort of since the last government elections in the local government sphere. So I think that was 2021. And it's been run by five different parties together. So you had IFP, the ACDP, I think COPE at some stage, Action SA, the DA, and the FF Plus, and they were all kind of running it together. And the mayor there, Silas Brink, is well regarded, hardworking, honest, and trying to clean up the city with this big coalition partners. So Action SA, who kind of said from the beginning their biggest focus was that they wanted to get rid of the ANC, to say that they were suddenly going to turn over the city to the ANC, really for no reason. Like, it's not like there was some kind of corruption going on or something like that. They just said no, or they felt like it, essentially. That would have been very, very shocking, and would have actually probably required also the help of the EFF as well. So there's a lot of movement and a lot of flux still in the political system. And I think one way to think about it, because that's kind of what I wanted to do for a few minutes, was to actually think about what the hell does this all represent. Because on the one hand, you could kind of just say, well, you know, this is just a sort of normal part of politics. Things change. It does happen. From time to time, you have changes in the councils. But I think it's more than that. Also, because we had local government elections last week where there were a few upsets in general, but MK taking a seat off the ANC, the DA losing a seat in independent here and there, like, but nothing sort of catastrophic or suggesting a big change in the electorate. So what this tells me is that the electorate is kind of pretty settled on what's going on, but the rest of the political system is starting to have to accommodate the power demands that have been foisted on it by the GNU. And I think the way to think about it is a kind of tectonic plate, right? So you've got big forces that are rubbing up against one another, in this case actually together. You've got the ANC and the DA, who really couldn't have sat around and had a cup of tea for a long time. And now suddenly they were sort of coming together and bashing into one another. And they've joined, essentially, in the GNU at national level. and what's happened is that when you get these sort of, you basically get tremors that are, the GNU was a big earthquake, really, in political science terms, and that had happened in 3 months ago, and what we're still feeling is the tremors throughout the system, because the rest of the part of the system hasn't accommodated yet what has been the outcome of this sort of earthquake in the system. And so smaller parts of the plates are falling off, others are filling in, stuff is being pushed up and out, and all over the place the political system is having to accommodate this new reality that is the GNU. And because there wasn't enough time for a full agreement, it means that provincial level administrations can act differently to local level. So for example, in KZN, the ANC and the DA and a bunch of others kept the MK out and had a government of national unity type arrangement there, and it works pretty well. Whereas in Gauteng, the ANC, Panyaza Lesufi, is holding onto his hat and is making big statements about how the ANC needs to change and do something different, and otherwise he's going to die. But they're really trying to hold on to as much power as they possibly can. to the extent that he decided instead of working with the DA, he would actually run a minority government, which is actually easier to do at the provincial level because you need to get less votes through through the provincial legislature. So minority governments can be done. It just comes budget time that things become a little bit more hairy. So it hasn't managed to filter all that well to the local level. And then the smaller parties that were part of the what they called the Moonshot Pact, so or the multi-party charter, they're all eyeing the 2026 local government elections. So we're already starting to talk about that, right? We're in 2024, we're sort of towards the end of that, but really we're sort of starting to see, within 2 years, less than that, 18 months, we're having another election, and the smaller parties are trying to figure out where it is that they can go. So parties like Action SA, which had not the greatest electoral outcome, are trying to see where they can sort of get hold of power. You've got the FF Plus who shed some votes, and you're seeing some stuff around them as well. So these smaller parties, I think, are trying to take some kind of power while they can to demonstrate to the voters that they are in the position to actually do something and be effective as political parties. You've got a couple of others who are just in opposition in all places and haven't joined the GNU. So the ACDP has maintained an opposition stance. You've got Borsa, who is there. In some cases, you've got Raz Mzanzi, who is not, but is sitting in the government in Gauteng and a couple of other places. And so all of this is kind of swirling around. Now, it's going to take a bit of time for these parties to figure out where their niches are, and not everything is going to be positive and not everything is going to be negative, but you are seeing that settling process. But on the whole, it's still kind of working. The big risk and the big icebergs coming up is that the ANC is still acting in some respect like it is still in charge and is doing things that probably aren't going to pass muster in the GNU. So one of them is the NHI, which has been rejected roundly. But the ANC is still pushing to do regulations now for it. There's other issues going on where it is focusing on this corruption issues, where the justice minister seems to be caught up in this VBS issue. There's a few other things that are out there. And the question is there enough pushback going to come from inside the government and outside the government to actually change things? Because I think one of the things about the GNU is that where you have a portfolio and you've got a determined minister, things can start to change. So in the DA's Leon Schreiber, for example, he's cutting all sorts of regulations and changing the way we do immigration and clearing backlogs and whatever. But in foreign affairs, we're still seeing Ronald Lamola basically still working off the same script that Naledi Pandor worked with, just like less loudly. Although he's, you know, is compromising, and I see he's now going to Japan, which the South African government had previously snubbed. But we have Chinese ships doing so-called medical work in our bays, and we've got our Navy working with Iran. So it's not so simple that what's going on the foreign affairs front. So it's going to be a question, I really think, of where they decide to take it and where it decides to go. But if some of the big-ticket items really come down to a vote, then the GNU will collapse. And goodness knows what will happen then once those tectonic plates come apart. So that is where we are at with the GNU. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
Now, you are listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and we are covering the various issues of the day on the show, as we do every single week. And one of the big stories that came out on Friday, which is important for the community in Cape Town, is the issue of the University of Cape Town. And it seems as though a number of professors, a number of them are Jewish in origin, have actually decided to sue the university. So what is going on and why? And the answer to that comes around the question of the attempted boycott of Israeli universities by various parts of South African academia. And you might know that this has been an ongoing issue in South African academia for a while. In 2010, the University of Johannesburg passed a resolution that said that it won't work with Israeli universities and cut off a research agreement that it had with the University of Ben Gurion. And there's been from time to time declarations from like smaller non-important universities in the country that have also said that they won't work with Israeli universities. So I think like University of Fort Hare, or TUT, there's been declarations that they won't do anything. But the most serious one was about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when the University of Cape Town started a process to disrupt academic agreements with Israeli partners. Now, what's kind of interesting is that on the one hand, the University of Cape Town doesn't have any formal engagements with Israeli universities. So there's no research, learning, and teaching happening at a formal level. There's no agreements, MOUs, etc. But at the same time, research suggests that actually it might be responsible, that particular university, for the most number of collaborations between Israeli and South African academics on a variety of issues. And I think part of this is because there's a lot of international consortiums that operate out of UCT, particularly in the health sciences sector, where you'll have 5 or 10 or 6 or 12 or whatever universities from around the world who are all collaborating on like a big issue like malaria or cancer or something like that. And so different university professors are all working together. And as a result, you get a lot of Israeli input because, of course, in stuff like health sciences, they have a lot of expertise. And so on the one hand, UCT had no agreements, but on the other hand, they had a lot of research. And so there was a big push around more than 6 or 7 years ago to try and basically stop all interaction with Israeli academics, including this very McCarthyist idea of a committee that would look and see if something was Israeli enough or not Israeli enough to be researched at UCT. There was going to be a whole committee that was going to look into this, etc., etc. And that went all the way up through the university systems. So it started out in being a demand of some academics and a few students. Then it went to the Academic Freedom Committee. From there was a big debate at the Senate, and the Senate decided that they, after a number of hours, decided first no, then yes. And so they said they wanted a boycott. That went up to council. Council had a whole big debate about it, went back down to the Senate. And then the Senate basically took a resolution not to follow this path anymore, and this issue died. However, with the coming of the war, what has happened is that it has focused attention once again on the university, and these groups that had previously been silent got up and going again. And they then went to the Senate, and there was, again, the Senate had a discussion about this, and then the motion got rejected, and then after that, it went back to the council. It got rejected, then they had to do it again. This time it passed, the new kind of thing, then it went to the council. And this time there had been a change in the composition of the council. There wasn't a proper vice chancellor anymore. And so in this kind of gap in this process, the council actually voted to follow up on this particular thing. And I think that was what has happened. And of course, this has enormous problems and enormous issues for UCT, not just because of the research that they're losing, but also because of the various international donors and supporters of UCT, that some of which are Jewish, some of which are not, students that are supported by philanthropy, etc. And this has meant that that the university and the incoming vice chancellor now has a problem in regards to what they're going to be doing. And out of all of this now, there is a new vice chancellor, but also the university is now being sued by some of its staff, particularly Adam Mendelsohn. He's from the Jewish Studies Department, and I suppose he's one of those departments that is going to be particularly hard hit by a boycott such as this, because it affects his work and the ability of him to bring out scholars and do research and engagement. And so now we have these academics. They are going to court, and they're going to be targeting the university and trying to see if a court can adjudicate whether this thing is constitutional, whether it can be done, whether it was done in a way which is properly done according to the university systems, etc. So that is the what's going on in the in the Western Cape. The Zionist Federation has come out and said that they are in support of this, and that they're going to be assisting. So it's an interesting development, and one where we'll have to see whether the university takes it seriously, because there's a question about if they are going to basically deal with their flank of anti-Israel academics, or are they going to do what's right for the students and research and academic freedom and continue to go moving forward. And that's the real question. So it is a continuous fight, and one that we will definitely keep following here on the show. So yeah, that is what is going on at UCT, and something that we're going to have to follow very, very carefully.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. That was some freshly ground, nice spring music just to keep us in the mood on this Monday morning. Just to get you, maybe if you're not out of bed yet, if it's 9:30 and you're still trying to get out of bed, I completely understand. And hopefully that actually assists you with that process. Or if you've gotten into the office and would like to be going back to bed, maybe this helps to keep you awake. You never know. We do our best. One can only try and see. Now, it's nearly Rosh Hashanah time in a sort of general sense of the word, because it is Elul coming up Wednesday, I think. And it's a time of the year when we think about the year that had passed, and indeed it's not been a very easy one. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But it's also a time when we look forward to Rosh Hashanah and a sweet new year. And so honey is obviously used in a lot of the ceremonies, including the apple dipped in honey. And it looks as though a particularly sweet new year might be found for some rural women in South Africa who are benefiting from Israeli technology and some Jewish philanthropy. What am I talking about? Well, it's called the Ubuntu Beekeeping Initiative, and a number of partners have come together to actually work on this particular initiative, including the Mensch Network, which is a group of Jewish social entrepreneurs, as well as Ripples for Change, which works in rural areas in the Eastern Cape, and also the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. Now, if you've never heard of them, or you may have heard of them, they're often referred to as the Joint. It was basically set up to help particularly, I think, Russian and many others who were fleeing from Europe in various times in the last century. And it's an American organization, very, very famous for doing large-scale work and working inside the Jewish community. They still have huge programs in the former Soviet Union, doing different things for people there. And over time, they've also started to work first in Israel, which is a big part of their portfolio, but then also in the non-Jewish world. So famously, one of the projects was something called Tov, which was a microfinance program that was run between the Israeli Innovation Authority and Ethiopia. And basically, what they were doing was getting micro grants to farmers so that they could get irrigation technology, drip irrigation, for their crops, and using that to help to drive the changes that they had been involved in. And that was a very useful process. and something that Ethiopian farmers managed to get a lot of out of. And there's also been a lot of South African businesses that have worked in some of their projects. So that is the context of JDC. And because of this, they have this process where they look to try and find projects where they can bring technology, Israeli technology, and expertise, more importantly, into helping different groups. And this is where the Ubuntu Honey project comes from. And essentially, it works with rural farmers that are looking to become beekeepers. And they help them with to establish thriving honey businesses. Then they're provided with comprehensive training, essential equipment, market connections. And this helps them to learn the art of beekeeping and to develop a profitable honey enterprise, which is, you know, really kind of hugely important for people in that area that have no background in this kind of thing and can actually learn. And of course, bees are crucially important for the ecology, because they pollinate the flowers, and that helps to actually support. Support pollination and the growing of food and also, and we have a range of bees in South Africa that do this, especially the Cape honeybee, which is a very positive one. And so now the first bee products are starting to come onto the shelves, and you can actually get them. So what better way to make Rosh Hashanah a sweet year for someone than to go and get some bee honey that is made with Jewish support in South Africa and Israeli input. I think it's absolutely fantastic. So if you want to go check it out, just Google the Ubuntu Beekeeping Initiative on the Mensch website, and you can see all about it. You can see all the different products, everything that you want in order to take advantage if you are into your honey and would like to see how that can be supported. So that is that particular issue done. Ubuntu Beekeeping Initiative, just in time for Rosh Hashanah.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
Now, I did promise you some archaeology today, so let's see what is interesting and new that is being found in the Holy Land. And it looks as though an extremely rare seal has been discovered that is from the First Temple period, about 2,700 years ago. And it's one of the most beautiful ever discovered, found near the southern wall of the Temple Mount. Also bears the name of Yehuzira ben Yeshayahu on it, in what's called Paleo-Hebrew, which I can only assume is a previous kind of Hebrew that hadn't, you know, before the current existing script that we have at the moment. And the seal discovered in the Davidson Agricultural Garden during excavations conducted by the Israeli Antiquities Authority and the City of David organization. According to Yavul Baruch, who is an excavation director at the Israeli Antiquities Authority, the seal is made of black stone and is one of the most beautiful ever discovered in excavations in ancient Jerusalem, and is executed at the highest level of artistic creativity. The object has an engraving with mirrored writing and served its owner as an amulet, as well as for legally signing documents and certificates. It has a convex cut on each side and a hole drilled through its length so that it could be worn as on a chain and around its neck. And in the center is a figure depicted in the profile, possibly a king with wings. And the figure appears with a long striped shirt and strides towards the right. The figure also has a mane of long curls covering the neck, and it's on its head. On its head is a hat or a crown. Also has one arm raised forward with an open palm, perhaps holding some kind of an object. And then it has the name of the figure, which I had already said, Lehezua ben Yeshayahu, on it as well. And this seal is quite unusual because, for a number of reasons. First of all, it's this kind of genie theme, this idea of something with wings as a protective magical figure, is the first time that's been found in Israeli regional archaeology, because winged figures of this kind, known as winged demons, are known in the Neo-Assyrian art of the 7th and 9th centuries BCE and were considered a kind of protective charm. The researchers believe that the object may have originally appeared alone and was held by a man who had a senior position in the Kingdom of Judea's administration. And because of his status, he was allowed to give himself a seal with such a large and strange figure on it. And it looks as though the object was made by local craftsmen who produced it at the owner's behest. And it looks as though it's done at a very high level. And it looks as the argument is that the amulet may have been passed down from father to son. And that is why the name was then written on to the amulet after the father died. And the name Yehoshua is Yehoshea is familiar to us from the Bible. It's in Chronicles in abbreviated form, and it's seen as seen in the name of one of King David's fighters. It's also in the book of Jeremiah, describing events from this period, and a person is also mentioned in parallel with that name. That you can actually see. So the name is found in the Bible and fits then into the context of the first temple period. Now, comparing the shape of the letters and the writing of those of other Hebrew seals from Jerusalem shows that in contrast to the careful engraving of the figurine, the names on the seal were done in a sloppy manner, and it's possible that the son may have engraved his name on something which already had the father's amulet, and the son came and wrote his name on it. Also shows, according to archaeologists, that evidence of writing abilities which existed in this period, because up till now it's been assumed that literacy may have been fairly low, but there is some suggestion that people did at least know how to read and write for the needs of commerce, and we know this from many written seals in this particular script that has been seen around. The figure also gives us another clue about the time of that era, because of this Assyrian style, it's a very rare thing to find in the area of Jerusalem. And it shows the influence of the Assyrian Empire, which had conquered the entire region at that point. And it's very, very clearly evident. And so Jerusalem and Judea at the time was subject to the hegemony of the Assyrian Empire and was influenced by it. But the seal's owner chose this particular combination, the Hebrew and the Syrian stuff, to show that he was part of both. And so it's a very interesting find, and shows us what Jerusalem and the First Temple would have been like 2,700 years ago. And you can actually go see a picture of this thing. It is on Israel National News website, and you can see the carving, you can see the face, you can see the wings, and you can see the Hebrew as well as the way that it was worn. How you can imagine that this person was someone who was important authority, and he would have a document, and then he would take the wax and put these seals inside the wax, and then and put it and seal the document to be sent somewhere else, so that people who required to actually be able to see it would actually be able to do so and know that it had not been opened by anybody else. So really, really fascinating and a beautiful beautiful piece of archaeology and interesting find that we have over there. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. And I did want to just take a moment to reflect on what had happened yesterday. I think for Jewish people around the world, the horrific news that we got that the hostages that had been held for 11 months by Hamas, including the Pollan family, who had been actually at the Democratic National Convention talking about their son and how to Hirsch and how to get him out. That was a big news in the States about a few weeks ago during the Democratic National Convention. Other hostages, including those who had actually been taken, not so much at the Nova Festival itself, but had actually gotten people out and went back to go fetch more people, but had been taken by Hamas. So really a range of hostages from different places and different communities that people had really been campaigning for and thinking about. And it seems as though that within the last 72 hours that Hamas had just decided to actually just execute them instead of handing them over. And it just shows all of the horrificness which is connected to the war, and the fact that there's still 101 odd hostages that are left that we still have to figure out some sort of way to get out. And unfortunately, instead of serving as a point of unity and a point of connection for the Jewish world, we've also seen this horrific outcome where we were seeing protests in Israel and a lot of division, and I think it's something that we can't really afford, and just the general sadness and feeling that we've seen in the last 24 hours, and of course the funerals are happening today now that we have these bodies back. So it's a very, very difficult time for the Jewish world in general as we continue to deal with the aftermath of October 7th and what it means. So there is that element. But as I was I posted something, like many people were doing yesterday on Instagram and Facebook on this issue, but I got an interesting reaction from a lot of people, so I thought I would just share it. And that has to do with what I posted was, like many people, a yellow ribbon, of course, become the symbol of the hostages. And the yellow ribbons that I had actually posted was ones that were being beaded. A local craftsman in just by Waverley School, you often see there's like a circle with a lot of art nearby that school when you're driving by, and this local craftsman had decided that he would start making beaded yellow ribbons, and this was on the side of the road. And so I took a picture of these and purchased one from him for this, and I chatted to the artist a little bit, who said to me that people even connected to the station had actually been buying them and wanted to send a whole bunch to Israel. So I feel like it's just a small pinprick of light to see that someone, you know, in the middle of an intersection somewhere in South Africa, who's not necessarily directly connected to the Jewish community, sees the pain of what's going on, understands the dangers for all those involved, and is just sending their small bit of positivity into the universe that maybe even will get to Israel and will be affected for someone who will want to remember the hostages in a particular way in from South Africa. So I just thought that was sort of important to note, and you can go and check out, if you are by Waverley School, the yellow ribbons that are beaded there. Brings us to the end of the show for today. Thank you so much for everyone who helps make the show possible. Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons. Vusi's on the sound. And to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week, do join us again next week on the New Blue Review.